It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. In this new year, the Affordable Care Act's enhanced premium tax credits are gone. Those subsidies help to offset the cost of health care premiums for millions of Americans.
In Wisconsin, around 270,000 residents used those credits in 2025. Now, some people may decide not to pay for a health insurance plan as ACA Marketplace premiums more than doubled this year. That's according to the nonpartisan health policy research group, KFF.
So what happens if your coverage lapses and you need care?
We now turn to Tina Marshalik, Community Relations Coordinator and Health Insurance Navigator at Covering Wisconsin. That's a free navigator program within UW-Madison Extension that helps people enroll in ACA Marketplace Insurance and Medicaid. Tina, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Good morning. Happy New Year.
You too. And Trish Sarvella is here, Chief Development Officer of Partnership Community Health Center in Appleton. Trish, welcome. Hi, Trish. Can you hear us? I don't think we have Trish at the moment. Tina, let's start.
Good morning. I can hear you now.
Okay, great, great. Trish, you know, community health centers, they serve patients regardless of ability to pay using a sliding fee scale for services. What have you seen as these tax credits expire?
Well, quite honestly, we haven't seen anything yet as it has been impacting care. At Partnership, we see about 18,000 patients a year, and we are joined by 19 other health centers around the state. And what's really, I think, unique and exciting about community health centers is that we do offer a sliding fee scale for people who are uninsured or uninsurable. But one of the things that we found is that our health insurance navigators and certified application counselors have been able to really assist people to get onto plans that really meet their healthcare needs. Although things have gone up this year, certainly, we find that our patients really value their health insurance and have been willing to pay that extra amount to make sure that they stay in care for the coming year.
And some people may be new to a sliding fee scale. What should we know about this payment approach?
All health centers are required to offer a sliding fee scale based on household size as well as family income. So everyone's situation is a little bit different. And one thing that's really important for people to remember is that although maybe some of the adults in the family might not be eligible for programs on the Affordable Care Act or can't fund those themselves, our state Medicaid program keeps kids insured up to 300% of the federal poverty level. And for people wondering what that might be, that's a family of five up to about $100,000 a year. So I think we should always use that as an opportunity to look at how our state has really been proactive in making sure that children stay on coverage. So as we navigate these difficult times with increased prices, there are options for children.
Tina, turning to you at Covering Wisconsin, some people enrolled in ACA Marketplace plans, they may be seeing their premiums doubling or even tripling in cost. And as a navigator, have you seen an increase in people dropping out of coverage? What are you seeing?
Anecdotally, I have personally had more consumers go without coverage than I typically do during open enrollment, most notably for households that are above 400% of the federal poverty level, since they're categorically not qualifying for premium tax credits in 2026 unless enhanced subsidies are extended. And for those who may not be aware, 400% of the federal poverty level for a household of one is $62,600 annually. For a family of three, that's $106,600 annually. It's important to be aware, though, that subsidies are still available to many individuals and families on the marketplace. Not all subsidies have expired, and many of the people I work with have felt that the cost increase was something that they were willing and able to take on to avoid being uninsured, although that's not the case for everyone.
So you did see some people preparing for this moment in a way.
Yes, many people did seem like they were expecting the cost to be higher. And so when the costs were higher, they weren't necessarily shocked by it. Many people were very surprised by the cost increase, but not everybody had a shocking cost increase. Many people did, but not everybody was looking at their costs doubling. And some people, because there's been some misunderstanding in the public eye about what subsidies exactly are expiring, many people thought that all the subsidies were expiring, not just the enhanced subsidies that were given to the marketplace during the pandemic that were not extended. So there were some people who were expecting to have to pay full price when they still qualify for subsidies. And so their costs were much lower than they were anticipating.
And another clarification is that people have until January 15th to sign up for insurance through healthcare.gov. But what happens to coverage if they sign up now in this window?
If they are uninsured right now and they're signing up by January 15th, then that coverage would begin February 1st. So you could have a gap in coverage for January if you're currently uninsured and you're signing up on the marketplace right now. And you may want to reschedule any non-emergency appointments or procedures for when you have health insurance and take certain precautions for while you're uninsured, such as if you have an emergency, you can still go to the emergency room and looking into lower cost options during that time period.
We're talking about healthcare coverage in the new year, and we have Tina Marshalek, a community relations coordinator and health coverage navigator at Covering Wisconsin. Trish Sarvella is here with the Partnership Community Health Center in Appleton. I'm wondering, what options do people have to get enrolled in the state's Medicaid program in BadgerCare? Is that an option for people who lack health insurance? I mean, can people use free and charitable clinics with a lapse in healthcare coverage, Trish?
Absolutely. And that's the reason community health centers are here. We're here for everyone in need of care. And I think there's something really important to think about when we're moving into this period up until January 15th, for people to really come and take a look at what's available to them. And to Tina's point about all of the, I think, perceptions that people have about, wow, it's going to be too expensive for myself and my family. To talk to somebody like Tina or other navigators in your area to find out what's available, because we have found that healthcare costs are really regional. And what we might see in the national news may not be actually what's rolling out in the local community. And as people are navigating this, to make sure that they're not having a lapse in care, and community health centers will always be there for the community. We provide medical, dental, behavioral health care, and then all of the support services and wraparound services, as well as health insurance enrollment, to make sure that people are truly linked to coverage and to health care.
Have you seen an uptick in people signing up for catastrophic plans, though?
Tina,
go ahead.
Sure. Yes, I personally have, and bronze plans, just higher deductible plans to keep their monthly premium low. When somebody does pick a higher deductible plan and they're working with me, I make sure that they understand the risk of that, of the a high out-of-pocket cost that they could experience if they needed to use that care. Also, there are some bronze plans that have co-payments before the deductible so that you don't have to pay into that high deductible for everything. So you might have a $7,500 deductible, but when you go to see your primary care doctor, it's still just a $30 copay. And that can make the higher deductible plan more affordable for people, depending on what their needs are.
Are there risks with these catastrophic plans that people should know about?
Yeah, the risk is that if something catastrophic happens, you could still end up with a big bill if you have a $7,500, $10,000 deductible that you need to pay into. You'll still have an out-of-pocket maximum for your plan that should cap you in how many out-of-pocket costs you're paying in the calendar year. If that happens to you, you can reach out to the billing department and see if there is a financial counselor you can speak to. Many hospitals and health systems have financial assistance programs that you can apply for. They tend to be income-based. So how much of a reduction in cost you may qualify for can depend on your income. And if you qualify for any reduction in cost, can depend on your income. Also, sometimes repayment plans are available. You could look into setting up a repayment plan where you pay back the cost of your bill over a certain time period, like 12 months or 24 months, instead of having to pay it up front. You do want to respond promptly, though, to make sure that nothing is sent to collections.
Trish, your clinic is a federally qualified health center in Appleton. Do you have capacity to serve more patients at the clinic?
We certainly have capacity to serve more patients as we go forward from a clinical standpoint, but we do recognize that if we have a growing number of uninsured patients, the financial impact will be devastating because we know that having a payer source allows us to continue to provide care to those patients who are not eligible for insurance. So it's a real balancing act that way. I think health centers are challenged throughout the state and the nation with workforce. We know that there's a growing number of people who could and should be seen at health centers due to income or language or other services that they're looking for. But it's often hard to attract physicians, dentists, hygienists, behavioral health professionals. So as we struggle with workforce development strategies to make sure we're getting the right people into the positions, the community need continues to grow.
Oh, and so you see a gap then in the medical professionals area trying to recruit staff in order to serve your patients.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, Tina, I'm wondering, as you look down the road to how healthcare in 2027, you know, could face further uncertainties, what do you tell people as a navigator in terms of what they should do about making sure that they stay on top of their healthcare this year?
Well, if you have an emergency, please go to the emergency room. You still can be seen even though you don't have health insurance. Assuming you're uninsured in this scenario. Mm-hmm. And like I mentioned, if you get a bill that you can't afford to pay, to look into applying for financial assistance programs if they're there, and setting up repayment plans if that's an option for you. Looking into free and charitable clinics if you qualify for care at one, and you can call 211 to learn what the resources are in your area or what the free clinics are in your area. If you have prescriptions and you're either uninsured or you're having trouble paying for them through your insurance, there are some options sometimes, depending on your prescription, to maybe not bill your insurance or to go through something like GoodRx that can lower your costs. There are also some online pharmacies that can lower your costs. And if all else fails, you can potentially look into paying certain things out of pocket.
I was going to say, so definitely check around. Well, Tina and Trish, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
That is Trish Sarvella, Chief Development Officer for Partnership Community Health Center in Appleton, and Tina Marshalla, Community Relations Coordinator and Health Coverage Navigator at Covering Wisconsin. That's a free navigator resource helping people enroll in ACA Marketplace plans.
Coming up, Wisconsin kicks off an effort to put work requirements for certain Medicaid recipients into action by the end of this year, as required by a law passed by Congress. Advocates worry that the red tape could keep eligible people from getting coverage.
That's, to me, I think the biggest concern is that the people who really should be on it will likely be kicked off anyway.
That's ahead on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. New work requirements will kick in for people enrolled in Medicaid starting in 2027, and Wisconsin is among the states scrambling to implement that change by the end of this year.
The federal budget reconciliation bill passed in July requires that Medicaid recipients spend 80 hours per month at work or in job training in order to receive benefits. Congressional Republicans have celebrated the new requirements, and Senate Majority Leader John Thune says it's a common sense reform.
Advocates have expressed some concern about the change. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that nearly 5 million people would lose Medicaid coverage nationwide because of the new requirements, including people who might be eligible but who lose coverage because of administrative obstacles.
And polling from the health policy research firm KFF finds states will face challenges in preparing to administer the requirements by this time next year.
Jennifer Tolbert is Deputy Director of KFF's Program on Medicaid and the Uninsured. Jennifer, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you.
We are on the clock in Wisconsin. The state is to come up with our plan for how these Medicaid work requirements are going to go into action. Can you give us the basics, though? Based on that law passed in mid-2025, what are states like Wisconsin going to have to put into practice come 2027?
Right. So starting in January of 2027, so less than a year from now, states will need to verify that individuals applying for coverage or enrolled in coverage in Medicaid, and in Wisconsin, this means the individuals who are enrolled in the Badger Care Waiver, so adults without dependent children in that program, will now need to meet new work requirements. So they will be required to engage in work or qualifying activities such as community service for at least 80 hours per month or be in school full time. Now, there are some exemptions to these work requirements, including parents, adults who are pregnant, those who are medically frail, or who are participating in a substance use disorder program, among others.
Basically, a year for states to get this into action, which might feel like a long time. You surveyed a bunch of states. Wisconsin was not among the respondents, I understand. But what kind of challenges are states looking at as they figure out, okay, how are we actually going to put this into practice?
Right. The biggest challenge here, I think, is the timing, as you note. So in order to implement these work requirements, most states, in fact, all states, will have to make changes to their Medicaid eligibility systems. And these kinds of complex changes require both time and money, which will be in short supply for both for states. Another issue is that states are going to have to make some key implementation decisions prior to having full guidance from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which is the agency that oversees the Medicaid program. Things like who will qualify for exemptions, what kinds of documentation will be required, what data sources will states access to verify whether individuals are complying. Those kinds of decisions states are going to need to make before CMS likely issues guidance, which is expected by June of this year. And then I'll just note another challenge that states are going to face has to do with outreach to inform individuals about these new requirements. So the problem here is that not everyone is going to be subject to these new work requirements. So states are going to have to figure out how to get the word out to the people who need to comply with these new requirements without confusing other people on the Medicaid program who will not be subject to these requirements.
And then the bureaucracy involved in establishing that, you worked X amount of hours or you volunteered X amount. Some people it might be really easy. I have a pay stub from the restaurant I work with. Look, 20 hours, boom. Other people might be, I drove for Uber 30 hours that week, none the next week, and I volunteered at the food. Like, this could get really complicated, right?
Yes, very complicated. The law specifies that states are required to use available data sources where possible to verify whether people are meeting the requirements or whether they qualify for an exemption. But there are lots of people for whom they may not have information in traditional data sources like state wage databases or other sources that states regularly turn to. So I'm thinking particularly gig workers and those who may be self-employed who don't get that paycheck from an employer. And so there's not an employer to connect with. States are going to have to get creative and find and identify other sources that they will be able to access to gather this information. And then in the situation where a state cannot verify that someone is meeting the requirements or is exempt from the requirements, a key issue is going to be what kinds of documentation will be required to confirm that that person either is meeting the requirements or does in fact qualify for an exemption. And so these are really complex decisions that will impact how the eligibility systems need to be upgraded and changed. And so it's a lot of moving parts, again, that states are going to have to pull together in a very short time frame.
We've got a couple states that have tried this. Arkansas and Georgia got exemptions, waivers, I believe, under the first Trump administration. The Biden administration pushed back on them. Arkansas briefly did this. Georgia won a court case, so they had a longer track record. Has there been enough of that, though, to where states can look at those two states and learn anything?
Yes and no. I think experiences in both Georgia and Arkansas do highlight the challenges that all states are going to face as they implement these work requirements. I think particularly in Arkansas, the state engaged in an extensive outreach program and was able to actually use available data sources to match about two-thirds of enrollees subject to the requirements. So to identify that though two-thirds of the individuals either already complied with the work requirements or qualified for an exemption. But nevertheless, 18,000 people still lost coverage, many of whom were working or would have qualified for an exemption, but simply never reported to the state any information that would have allowed the state to confirm compliance. So I think making sure people understand what information they need to provide and within which what timeframes is going to be a significant challenge. And I think the experience in Georgia also highlights the sort of unique challenge of requiring verification at application. These are individuals who may be newly applying for Medicaid and for whom the Medicaid agency really does not have any information available. And so it's going to be particularly tricky, especially for people who may qualify for an exemption, trying to gather the right information to ensure that people who are medically frail, who do have serious complex either physical or mental health conditions, are not denied coverage because the state has no way of knowing that they in fact have these conditions.
Now, between these work requirements and some other changes, probably, according to the Congressional Budget Office anyway, some millions of Americans would lose Medicaid coverage because of these changes with the work requirements. Some of them could be, well, they're not working or volunteering enough. Some of them could be they are working, but they're not jumping through the hoops. They're not providing the right documentation. The general sense is, though, this is going to lead to fewer people getting health care coverage. Do I have that about right?
You do. In fact, the Congressional Budget Office has estimated that there will be 5.3 million more people uninsured in 2034 because of these new Medicaid work requirements. And again, as you note, this may be because some people simply don't meet the requirements. But in many cases, people are meeting the requirements or qualify for an exemption, but simply cannot meet the documentation requirements to prove that. So the work requirements in Medicaid are the largest source of coverage loss estimated by the Congressional Budget Office.
Jennifer, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Jennifer Tolbert is Deputy Director of KFF's program on Medicaid and the uninsured. To learn more about how this could impact some providers that care for Medicaid patients in Wisconsin, Scott Stewart joins us, CEO of the Wisconsin Primary Healthcare Association. They represent the state's 19 community health centers. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Happy to be here.
Now, before we get into the possible impact of work requirements for Medicaid recipients, one thing I want to hammer home really clear, if we haven't done it enough already, this is not going to kick into effect in 2025. 2026. People shouldn't be worried about the work requirement and satisfying it in this calendar year. Do I have that right?
That is correct. And we are pretty clear on that usually is like, hey, like we do have a year to figure this out. And so, yes, luckily we still have some time.
Okay. So we're in that process now. The state will be figuring out how to administer this. Your association, now you work with health centers where there are a lot of Medicaid patients, up to 70% in some cases Medicaid funded. What do you see the potential when they do come into effect as scheduled in 2027, the potential impact on the centers you work with?
Yeah. And so, you know, I think I'm going to speak maybe quickly to just all of the things that are kind of happening in this healthcare space right now, right, is If it was just Medicaid work requirements that we were trying to figure out, that'd be one thing, right? It'd be okay, great. We have a plan in place. We can figure out how we balance the money that's coming in and make sure that we have sustainability. But I think for me, it's the fact that we're facing just kind of death by a thousand cuts, I'll call it, right? It's, you know, the ACA subsidies are going into effect this year, where those are going away. And so that will have an impact in some way, shape, or form on our health center's revenue. We then have a whole bunch of miscellaneous things like 340B being impacted. And so that's having an impact this year on our health center revenue. And then when you look at the Medicaid cuts coming up, that's going to be the real big piece, right, that will impact us the most. When you look at it across the state, just in 2024, about 55% of our patients were on Medicaid and 20% were uninsured. And when you look at that, I think in 2025, we're going to see a pretty dramatic increase in that already, just because a lot of the administrative changes that have happened over the last year. And then I think from there, I think you're going to see a really pretty significant impact starting in 2027 to really, I think, hit the home for our health centers to have a really big, significant revenue impact. You know, we were started as health centers to really help support not only the uninsured, but also the Medicaid and other kind of underserved and patients that are out in the communities that we serve. And that, I think, for us, you know, our sustainability really comes with making sure that we have a good payer mix that involves Medicaid. And when that goes away, that's a huge revenue hit for us. And so I worry about sustainability for our health centers long term to really make sure that they can continue providing the high level of services that they're providing to fill the gaps in the communities and as a key safety net provider that really is you know, we don't think around it until they're gone, right? But those safety net providers are there all the time. And then when you start to impact our safety net, then we worry around where do patients actually get care? Where do patients go when they need services? And that's what I worry about, I think, broader for not only our health centers, but our communities.
And then zooming in on the work requirements themselves, you've said elsewhere, including, I think, talking to one of our reporters earlier this year, you don't necessarily see a lot of benefit. What kind of concerns do you have about who would be impacted by that work requirement?
Yeah, I think it's multifaceted, I think, on that one. One is, you know, we know that a lot of people who are on Medicaid already are usually working. I think the last statistic I saw was something like 90% or something like that, right? So it's a pretty significant amount that are already working. The problem with this is that it's administrative burden, right? And so you think around, you know, I have friends and family who are on Medicaid. And so you think around, hey, you know, if it's going to be every single week, I have to go in and check in with Medicaid and tell you that I'm working the required number of hours. That's just an administrative burden that we're adding onto the system that will automatically kick people out in some way, shape, or form. And we saw that in the public health emergency in many ways, right? We had to really extend a lot of resources to make sure that people knew what they needed to do to submit those requirements. Separately, right, it's what I worry around is the populations who really should be on Medicaid. So, you know, the folks who would qualify for exemptions, who would have the ability to be on but may need additional assistance, or now we have to involve our providers, right? Our clinicians have to get involved and make those decisions to say, hey, you are actually considered someone who could be medically frail, or all those different pieces that come into play around how do we make sure that the people who are required, who should be on Medicaid, actually stay on. And now it's just adding that additional step, right, on how do we make sure that to actually qualify that person, to make sure that they have the paperwork and the documentation on it. And so that's really, it's like, again, it's really a small population that you're saying are actually going to be impacted on it, right? But that still equals about 270,000 people that will likely in Wisconsin lose Medicaid in some way, shape, or form. And so that's to me, I think the biggest concern is that the people who really should be on it will likely be kicked off anyway because they won't be able to meet the administrative burdens that are now placed on the program.
Right. So KFF estimates that nationwide, nearly 5 million Medicaid recipients would lose coverage because of work requirements. Your concern, it sounds like, is that's not the person who could be working but isn't. Your concern is that, hey, the person is working or volunteering enough to meet the requirements, but they didn't get the paperwork right, or they have medical reasons where they can't work and they didn't get the paperwork right. Am I hearing you right?
I think that's exactly right, yes.
If the state came to you as they're trying to implement this, because this is federal law now, they're going to have to do it unless that changes over the course of 2026, and said, hey, we got to put this thing in place, what would you want to see for guidelines to expedite this, to make sure that as little of that kind of bureaucratic loss of Medicaid happens. What would you tell them?
Yeah, I do think the nice thing is there are a lot of opportunities, I think, for the state to play a really significant role in helping to kind of bridge those gaps. You know, one thing being, right, that SNAP already requires work requirements. And so the state has been assessing how do we actually work with the SNAP program and combine these two to kind of help with bridging the gap on those work requirements so there's less submission, right? Usually people who are on Medicaid are going to be on SNAP in some way, shape, or form. So I think there's a lot of connection there that I think is helpful. I'd also say is how do we just make it, you know, there's a lot of background information that the state already gets. And so how do we just continue to combine and utilize the data that we're already receiving to make the biggest impact, to minimize the burden on the provider, to minimize the burden on the patients that are going to be on that? And so I think that's really, I think, where we can play a really significant role. The challenge being that, you know, when even on the SNAP requirements, they are different than the work requirement, the varying different levels and work requirements for that will be for Medicaid. And so you start to have some separation on like, how do you actually combine these systems when they're actually looking at separate things, right? Or they have different requirements that they have to meet. So there's like things like that that really come into play that make it challenging and concerning. And there's just a lot of differences with how this will all operate. The nice thing being, I will say that I'm grateful to have a state administrative office and an executive office that actually really is looking to make sure that they can do that as easy as possible for all of the patients who are on Medicaid right now. And so we have already been in conversations with the state, luckily, especially, you know, the Medicaid office, to talk through, hey, how can we minimize this? How can we work with you? And they are very receptive of that. And so I'm grateful that we have that. My worry, though, right, is that the minute that these get implemented, we're going to be having a potentially new governor, right? And so that administrative side may change drastically, right? And just because of our state elections. And so that philosophy at the office may change a little bit, depending on who comes in. And so there's a lot of, I think, concerns on the state level on what does that end up looking like long term.
Scott, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for reaching out.
That was Scott Stewart, CEO of the Wisconsin Primary Healthcare Association. Earlier, we heard from Jennifer Tolbert, Deputy Director of KFF's Program on Medicaid and the Uninsured, been talking about changes to Medicaid, which will require proof of employment or job training starting in 2027.
Coming up, a Wisconsin arborist teaches classes to women and others looking to share a love of trees and basic chainsaw skills.
We get into how the chainsaw works down to the finer points, of the cutter teeth on the chain.
That's next from WPR News.
You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCullum with a story about a chilly outing in Milwaukee that took place more than a century ago.
People do a lot to make the best of Wisconsin's brutal winters. Some strap on snowshoes or hit the sledding hills. The extremists participate in polar plunges. As Milwaukee historian and author John Gerda reminds us, the winter thrill seekers have been thriving in the area for a long time.
Were our ancestors really hardier than we are? Were they better equipped to weather Wisconsin's winters? One story says they were. On New Year's Day in 1895, 10 young men took the Milwaukee River from North Avenue all the way to Thiensville, a distance of 18 miles on ice skates. One of them, Joseph Bell, left a chronicle of the adventure and its warm reading on a cold winter's day. Wearing knickerbockers, thick sweaters, and strap-on skates, the group left Milwaukee at 10 in the morning. Many skaters were upon the ice for the first few miles north, wrote Bell, but we had only to climb over the first weir of frozen waterfalls where the dull roar of the under cataract sounded solemn and uncanny to leave behind all these ephemeral merrymakers and the last view of the city. That cataract would have been in today's Estabrook Park. The real fun started once they had the river to themselves. But the skating, Bell enthused, such skating as it was, such ice and such a winter's day, as one might wait an entire season for to see, Not a stirring of the air, save that we made ourselves as we rushed along the smooth black surface. The skaters were on uncharted ice with plenty of hazards ahead. Their leader plunged into waist-deep water at the first flour mill and Bell himself belly-flopped through what he called a 2-inch layer of slush water spread over a surface of sunken ice. But there were pleasant surprises as well. In shallow parts of the midstream, he recalled, we could see the fishes through ice clear as window glass. The Milwaukeeans reached Thiensville in 3 hours and 40 minutes, traveling at an average speed of 5 miles an hour. The pot of gold at the end of their rainbow was a prearranged royal good dinner of turkey and goose at Memler's Inn, a German place on the river. The skaters, Bell reported, were famished. I am afraid the smiling folk who gazed at us through the sliding panel from the kitchen must have wondered if we had ever had a square meal in our lives. In half an hour, the table looked as if a typhoon had struck it amidships. After a full meal and a few drinks, most of the travelers took the train back to the city. Not Joseph Bell and two of his heartier companions. Even though night was falling, they decided to skate home by moonlight. And that, according to Bell, was the best part of the journey. On we sped at ever-increasing pace until we had reached the limit for safety, and only tempering our speed when crackling surface ice and the opaque appearance of the river ahead warned us of rapids underneath and ticklish skating above. Despite their best efforts to read the river, the skaters experienced several somersaults, wrote Bell, and one of them plunged into a waterhole 2 feet deep. The trio reached the North Avenue Bridge at the stroke of 8, with their clothing frozen hard and clanking like steel armor. Bell still faced a long streetcar ride home to the west side, but he had no regrets. Truly, it was entrancing, that return trip, and romantically beautiful. By far the most conspicuous recollection that remains to me of the entire outing. You don't have to skate to Thiensville and back, but Joseph Bell's chronicle is a welcome reminder of winter's unique potential for fun. Bell and his buddies had the right idea. Unplug, they might tell their modern-day descendants. Turn off those tyrannical screens. Get outside and enjoy winter like genuine four-season Wisconsinites.
John Gerda is a Milwaukee-born author and historian. He's written 23 books on the history of the city. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowland Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is WPR News. The forestry industry has historically been a male-dominated field, led by classic images of muscular lumberjacks chopping down trees to manage forests.
But a longtime Wisconsin arborist is trying to help change that image.
Rebecca Seibel recently partnered with the Dane County Parks Department to teach chainsaw safety classes specifically geared toward women and gender minorities.
She experienced what it was like to come up through the industry as a woman, and she wants to help support the next generation of interested outdoors women.
She's a board-certified master arborist and owner of Tree Spirit Consulting in Holman in western Wisconsin. I talked to her right before the holidays. Rebecca, to start, how underrepresented are women in your field?
Ooh, that's a great question. And like a lot of things, it's going to depend on how you parse out the details. So there's a fair few women in the field of arboriculture, which is professional tree care. But if you drill down a little bit and say how many women are field climbing arborists, then you start to get a much, much smaller percentage.
What led you into that line of work, given that there might not be as many role models with the chainsaws and up in the trees?
Well, that's also a great question. My background is in biology. It's in environmental physiology, actually. But I found myself gravitating towards working outside, and I have an athletic background, and so I love nature. So being able to be out in nature where every day is different is a challenge, and then you get to use your body to climb the trees. It's an added challenge, and then every time you're pruning a tree, you're leaving something behind. So it's like this winning trifecta of being able to be active, being able to be outside, and then having a a living legacy of work, if you will.
Give us a sense of what a field arborist is out there doing. You mentioned being up in trees, pruning them. What else goes into that job?
Right. So I'm a consulting arborist. So I'll do, you know, consultations for people who say, hey, what's wrong with my tree? And it may or may not need pruning. Unfortunately, sometimes our only option is to remove the tree. But a field production arborist is going to have to climb up into the canopy to take out deadwood or to clear a skylight, for instance, from away from the house. And so on the daily, you might be doing fruit tree pruning in late winter, or maybe you're climbing a great grand red oak and just taking all the deadwood out of it. Or you may be having to do an ash removal, which is dead from the emerald ash borer. So it takes a lot of physical skill, but then it also is this great blend of biology and physics. And then you're working on a crew, so it's a lot of teamwork. So field arborists get to do, let's just say, a lot of different problem-solving things.
Now, in addition to being an arborist, you're teaching people. You're doing these classes that involve, among other things, chainsaw skills. What got you into that, and what do you like about the classes you're teaching?
The momentum, I say, of my career pushed me into teaching. And what I mean by that is, wherever I found myself working, I somehow was the crew leader or the safety director, and I always got the new guys. So the company would give me the new people, and I would take the new people out and teach them knots and teach them the ways of the day and how to be safe around the chipper and some chainsaw skills. And once I started building momentum, you know, teaching climbing workshops and then doing some safety oversight out west in the wildfires and just becoming a full-time trainer over a number of years.
Now, in these classes, you've got counties and I think others bringing you in. And in some cases, it sounds like you're teaching first-timers, right, who may never have hefted a chainsaw before. What is that learning process like?
Yes. Sometimes I've got people who are completely new to the tool. Sometimes I've got people who work for a municipality who only work with the chainsaw once or twice a year. And it's a challenge for someone to be able to teach sound fundamentals in a short period of time, plus kind of more advanced skills that are necessary to know if you're going to operate the chainsaw safely. And because the chainsaw is a hazardous tool, and because we have to learn by having hands-on, you know, it's not for the faint of heart, let's just say.
Yeah, are people who maybe didn't grow up using power tools like that, is there sort of an intimidation factor that you have to help talk people through before they could start picking it up and learning the safe techniques?
There definitely is some intimidation with the chainsaw, which is understandable because, like I said, it's a hazardous tool, or it can be. But like any hazardous tool, I mean, just think of driving a car when you first learned how to drive a car. Once you know what you're doing, you know the rules of the road, so to speak, and then you become comfortable so that you can mitigate the risks. And that's by work habits, and it's by driving habits. So it's a similar thing. And the more hands-on experience you get, the more competent and more comfortable one becomes with the tool, and then you can do more stuff.
We are talking about chainsaw safety and arborist education, making it more accessible for women and others who might not have grown up with it. Our guest is Rebecca Seibel from Tree Spirit Consulting in Holman in western Wisconsin. Okay, well, we don't have chainsaws in our hands, but what are the first things you teach people? What are the key skills we're going to take away when you're teaching us how to use it?
I start with the safety features of the chainsaw. There are certain things that if the chainsaw doesn't have, like it's not functioning, then the chainsaw has to stay on the shelf, has to get fixed. And, you know, a lot of times if you are working for a city or the chainsaw's out in the barn or something, or your husband or, you know, your partner is the one that's supposed to be responsible for keeping it up, and they're not a professional, a lot of those things are questionable if they're functioning or not. So we start with very basics. Then we talk about fuel and oil. Then we talk about the reactionary forces of the chainsaw and how to put yourself in the best work position to be the safest as possible. We get into how the chainsaw works down to the finer points, of the cutter teeth on the chain. And even we get into a little bit of maintenance and sharpening, and we do a lot of hands-on cutting.
Now, not everybody who takes your classes is going to go into the profession of being an arborist, but do you have hopes that some might, that some women or anyone who doesn't see themselves in this job might be like you and say, hey, wait a minute, there's a lot I like about this working outside and all the things you mentioned.
Oh, definitely. The field of arboriculture has got room for people who are doing invasive species management, ecological restoration, prairie restoration. Volunteer organizations, a lot of times, will be interested in taking the classes. But as a professional arborist, it's really a rewarding field. It's a rewarding career, because if you plant a tree, for instance, and I planted this spring, I will die, but the tree will go on. So there's a sense of the greater good and also leaving something that lasts beyond our lifetime on the earth. And we need a lot more of that.
And you've done, I think most of your work has been urban arboriculture. Do I have that right?
Right. I lived in Minneapolis for about 18 years. And so I did a lot of tree work where, you know, it's right next to a large house. So a lot of in the city where trees actually take on, I would say, even a greater importance than when you're in the woods.
Why is that?
Well, a lot of times there's a, say, an 80 or 100-year-old oak tree or American elm tree or a very key, say, basswood, and it'll hurt the house property a lot to lose it, but it also will take away from the aesthetic beauty of enjoying it while you're living there. You know, one big shade tree placed properly can really cut down on your heating, or your cooling, I should say, not on your heating, but on your cooling costs. And if someone was lucky enough to have someone else with the foresight to plant it in the right spot, then it's a growing asset.
Leave us with some encouragement to, even again, if we're not going to become arborists, even if we're not going to pick up a chainsaw, to get in touch with the nature, with the trees in our lives, whether we live out in the wild or in that big city.
Oh, I'd love to. So we need trees more than trees need us to mess with them. And what I want everyone to do is to be able to go for a walk in the woods or just appreciate that big tree on the boulevard right in the city and just pause for 5-6 seconds and realize that that's a living, growing being. And inside that tree or outside that tree on the bark, there might be lichens or there might be frogs that are huddled up in there, tree frogs. There's a lot of life in and surrounding trees. And then I'll even add, when they die, the trees and all the decaying wood that you find in the forest, that also is full of life. And the smell of it, and just taking the time to appreciate that's another living being that we live alongside, it puts things into perspective.
We'll leave it there. Rebecca, thanks again for joining us.
You are most welcome, Rob. Thank you for having me.
Rebecca Seibel is a board-certified master arborist, owner of Tree Spirit Consulting in Holman in western Wisconsin. She is with us today to share how to make arboriculture, forestry, and chainsaw safety more accessible and approachable for women and underrepresented gender minorities in those professions.
It's a new year, and for some people, that is time for New Year's resolutions. Rob, do you make resolutions in the new year?
Not exactly resolutions. I kind of have New Year's intentions, like things I want to do a little more, but not as formal as a full-on resolution.
Oh, okay. What are your New Year's intentions?
Okay. So I'm definitely overdue for some hangout time with various old friends. Got to get on that. Try some cooking styles I haven't done before, and get out for more swims. I think I saw some open water on the lake on my way in. Do you do resolutions, Kate, or anything like that?
I like the intentions instead instead of resolution. So I'm going to go with that. My intention is to do all my preventative care stuff on time. No procrastinating with those checkups.
Well, how about you? Tell us about your goals for this new year, whether or not they're full-on resolutions. Leave a message or send a text to 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. Or you can email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Wisconsin Today producers include Mackenzie Crummy, Trevor Hook, and Lauren Cox.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.